and a good morning to you. Coming up on 10 o'clock on a Thursday morning, and the Jason Van Dyke murder trial is about to begin. The jury has been called, will be seated shortly, and we'll get to the testimony once it starts. Let me introduce our guest for the balance of the, well, not for the full trial today, but for at least for several hours, Gal Pazitsky, who is a partner in Pazitsky and Berliner. You're a criminal defense lawyer. You know what it's all about. You've been in positions like this yourself. Why don't you just sort of sum up what we've seen from the defense in the past 3 days, now about to begin a fourth day of presenting evidence and witnesses?
Well, at first we saw some preliminary setting up as to what the defense is going to show later on in the week, and they called Dr. Tees, they called other witnesses.
That was had worked in the medical examiner's office, and as an expert witness, they paid her to talk about her. She somewhat discredited the autopsy itself and the information that was presented the week before under the prosecution's questions.
Right, so she discredited some of the autopsy, the procedures of how they conducted the autopsy, but then she also brought up an interesting question that squarely went against what the prosecution said, and that is how many times he was shot when he was still standing, rather than after he fell down. So.
And that's interesting, because the impression we have, though we do not have any audio on that infamous dash cam video, is that it seems within a shot or two, the victim, Maquan McDonald, spun and was on the ground.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's for the jury now to determine which side they're going to take. Are they going to believe the defense side, or are they going to believe what Dr. Tees or the prosecution side? And right after that, they started calling witnesses to talk about Laquan McDonald's background, meaning violent background. Even though Van Dyke didn't know about the background at the time, that is one of the ways that a defense has to prove up in order to claim self-defense. They have to show somebody's violent background.
They talked to several deputies and other employees of the Juvenile Corrections Center over a year earlier, who said that he had violent outbursts. He wrestled, he couldn't get handcuffs on him, he cursed, and again laying the groundwork that this was a violent, disturbed teen. And then going on yesterday with testimony, trying to make the case that he had been on what they called a wild rampage in the hours beforehand.
Right.
But again, as you just pointed out, that information was not relayed to the responding officers.
No, it was not relayed to the responding officer by the time the shots were fired. However, in order to prove up a self-defense case, the defense has to actually prove something. They have to prove what we call a prima facie case, so enough evidence in order to shift the burden and for to have Judge Gaughan allow them to have self-defense jury instructions at the end of the case. So they're slowly building up that case of self-defense.
This is that video that the jury has been seeing over and over again, as all of us in the public, and the defense is trying to claim what we seem to see here is not the perspective that Van Dyke or some of the other responding officers saw.
Correct. So they provided the defense provided their own video yesterday. I think it was a 4-minute video.
An animated recreation from the perspective of Van Dyke.
Correct. So it kind of looked like a video game. Or what video games look like today, but it was pretty accurate according to the witness to testify that he took the perspective, and here's the video that we're watching right now. It seems like what he says is that he took the actual video from the dash cam, he took some police reports that he read, he took the autopsy report, and he put this together. But if you can see in this video, it's very clear that we see that Laquan McDonald was not, doesn't look like he's attacking anybody, and he doesn't look like he's even holding a knife in that video.
Yeah, and it kind of disputes the initial police report that Van Dyke and a couple of other officers had filed, where they said his arm was up, he was swinging a knife, he was lunging toward me.
And it doesn't look that he is actually walking towards him. It looked like that he might have squared with him, but I don't know if Van Dyke was yelling at him or telling him to stop, but somebody, if he is getting yelled at and telling him to stop, it is possible that he turned towards him at some point. This is something that not clear to me.
Yeah.
And I think Van Dyke should testify.
Yeah. One of the officers yesterday, she had said that, well, what our perspective saw was his face. She was saying he looked deranged. Again, trying to lay the case that maybe that was indication of how he might have been a threat. And the idea that there was this couple of retail establishments, the Dunkin' Donuts, we now call it the Dunkin', I guess, and Burger King, and they wanted to keep him corralled so that he wouldn't wander off and cause harm there, because a truck driver who had first reported Laquan McDonald said he, and he testified yesterday, that he was lunging at me with this knife. Now, that too was not information that was relayed to these officers.
Correct. So it was not relayed to the officers, and I think, I know the defense called the truck driver to testify, but I'm not sure how that testimony came through to the jury, because at first he portrayed Laquan McDonald as this deranged person who was coming at him with a knife. However, he was able to stop that by telling him, I'm calling the police, or at least...
Yeah, that caused him to take off.
Right. So he threw some gravel at him. He threw the
his cell phone.
At him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then he called the police, and the guy ran away. Now, he also did not specifically identify Laquan McDonald through a picture or anything like that. He simply gave a description.
And a height that was, he thought he was a much taller man, over 6 feet. In fact, McDonald was, I think, 5'6", was it? Or?
Yeah, something around there. But so does that really, is the jury going to be convinced that it's not him? I don't know, because it's so close in time to the events. But that's another issue that possibly the prosecution is going to raise later on as a side note in their closing argument. By the way, we don't really know if this was him.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to hear both the jury instructions and the closing arguments. Typically, the closing arguments pretty much parallel what the opening arguments were, except that you are tying now specific testimony to specific individuals and evidence.
Correct. So opening statements is what we believe the evidence will show in the future, and you are not allowed to actually make real arguments. When you become a little bit argumentative, the judges will stop you if there is an objection. In closing arguments, you can give all your arguments. You can give all your hypotheticals. You can tell the jury, this is what I believe the evidence showed, and this is what I think happened, and this is what you heard from the testimony to prove that what I'm telling you is true.
Gail, you said, this is what I believe the testimony shows. This is what I believe. Can they be more affirmative than that? Say, you saw how this witness corroborates the point that they were in fear of their lives. That can you say things as affirmatives?
Absolutely. And a lot of times in trials, I would order the transcripts from the trial to directly quote the witnesses and what they said.
This was the truck driver, as I recall, who was testifying yesterday through an interpreter.
So if he, for example, said something that was really important for my closing argument or for my argument, I would order the transcripts from his testimony, and then I will quote him directly, so I won't have to say, I believe.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, this is, ladies and gentlemen, what he said to you a few days ago.
So the evidence yesterday from the officer when she was talking about this deranged look, imagine you're out there, there's a guy coming at you, you know he has been doing some bad things here, there's something in his hand. In fact, she said, we didn't know if it was a knife or a gun. You're trying to put the jury in the place of being Jason Van Dyke, and how would you respond? And all of these external forces causing impressions and the decision that you had to make very quickly as to what to do.
Correct. And remember, we have to talk about what the defense has to show. It's either self-defense or the defense of other as a police officer at the time, because he was acting on duty. He was on duty as acting as a police officer. He's protecting a police officer is supposed to protect the public and at times protect himself as well. So did he act in a way that was justified at the moment with a deranged person walking with a knife, squaring at him, or possibly going to a place where there's you know, other people and the public might be in danger there.
Would the judge intervene, or would the judge simply allow the prosecution to counter some of these points that, why are we talking about his violent behavior for a year previously? They didn't know that. Why are we talking about the violent behavior in the hours leading up to that? They weren't aware of that. I mean, the prosecution certainly will make that point, but is that something that a judge typically intervenes in saying, this is irrelevant because they didn't know that?
Well, so the judge already intervened prior to trial. These are pretrial motions that they had to hash out. I think the defense wanted to call a few other witnesses that the judge said no. So you have to, if you want to bring out somebody's bad background, prior bad acts, we call it, there's a rule of prior bad acts, or in self-defense, we call it lynch material. The judge, you have to bring it out to the judge before you call the witnesses pretrial.
So presumably that was done in this case, but yet they're still bringing out things that I would think, as a layperson, as an outsider, would have no bearing on whether I was trying to decide if Van Dyke was guilty or innocent, because he wasn't aware of these things at the time as he was standing there making the quick split-second decision on whether to pull the trigger or not.
Correct, but again, for the self-defense element, for the defense, they have to bring, when somebody has a violent background, they are obligated to bring that out.
Okay.
That's one of the ways that the law allows you to show the jury that somebody is a violent person. I am not the only one who was in fear from that person when he had that deranged look. And that's why they're bringing out, for example, the people from the juvenile facility to say he was deranged, this is how he acted back then, and this is what we saw with him when we tried to stop him or we tried to cuff him. And now Van Dyke is facing the exact same deranged look or behavior by McDonald, and therefore he was justified in his shooting.
The video animation that was presented earlier in the week stopped right after Laquan McDonald fell to the ground. It did not record, which obviously would be damning for the defense, the majority of the shots that were still being fired at him. When there are two counts of first-degree murder, what is the shading there in terms of what, I mean, you have one person who was killed, how can there be more than one count of first-degree murder?
Well, so you're asking me two different questions. You can have more than one count of first-degree murder because the statute allows for different wording to charge people. If he fired a gun and he did it intentionally, or he knew that it potentially will cause great bodily harm. So these are
two separate counts. That's
two
interesting.
Separate counts.
Yeah.
So it's the same exact event, but two separate counts. The first part of your question, I forgot. But when you charge somebody with murder, you usually, typically, prosecutors charge you with more than even two. I mean, I don't know how many counts exactly Van Dyke was charged with, but he might have been charged with more than two, but the prosecutor dismissed.
They dropped four, in fact.
Yeah. And they all merge at the end.
Gail Pisetsky, thank you very much. Let's now go to the courtroom where testimony has resumed in this trial.
Last night, we made the decision to show a portion of those videos instead of the entire video, and sent that to the prosecutor, and the court ruled that that we would not be allowed to show the video.
Mr. McMahon?
Because what we received last night was a series of videos that lasted several hours, well in excess of 1 hour. I don't know the total time, but one of the six videos in and of itself was more than 60 minutes. We objected to the use of those videos. We're not objecting to the testimony of the witness that they were supposed to, we're objecting to the use of those videos in front of the jury because of the late disclosure, because of our inability to cross-examine essentially the contents and the relevance of the substance of the witness. We objected to that. We sustained our objection. And those property in this one before the jury is found.
All right. As presented in chambers, there was a, Ms. Fleming said that one of the videos was tendered about 3 weeks ago. The other one was tendered about a month ago, not months.
Right.
I can read it back.
No, Judge, I didn't mean to insinuate.
No, I know. I understand. There was a lot of... Excuse me, I'm defending you. There was a lot of information presented at that time, so I know this is nothing intentional. It's just that there was a tremendous amount of information being discussed back there. So let the record be very clear that this was not an intentional misrepresentation. All right. The fact is, these were certain excerpts. There was additional matters. This person was a training officer when Mr. Van Dyke was going through the academy. Is that correct?
That's correct.
He will not be able to personally say that I remember Jason Van Dyke in my class. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And we don't have attendance sheets showing that he was there that day that that training was presented. That's another reason. The other reason is, has been stated, this is... case has been going on for several years. These tapes or videos were in existence since 2000. They're the same ones. So the lateness of the event and just being tendered the night before the witness was going to be presenting this information, that's why I'm going to deny, along with the reasons I gave in chambers, your request to play these videos. The other thing is, as Mr. McMahon has articulated, your expert witness will certainly be able to testify to everything that he presented at those training events. All right. We had another one concerning...
Yes, what? Mr. Rudolph Bennett was disclosed as a witness months ago, and today the state asked for an offer of proof, and by the offer of proof, which was essentially that Mr. Rudolph Bennett was the Bonnie DCFS worker. He was assigned to the Bonnie McDonald's case up until the death of Bonnie McDonald, and it was our intention to get into testimony from Rudolph Bennett about the fact that there was an investigation pending regarding the Bonnie McDonald's ability to live with his foster parent, who was his uncle. And depending on the results of that investigation, the Bonnie McDonald may have been sent back to the DOC. So we wanted to get into that information to show that on the night that the Bonnie McDonald died, that the Bonnie McDonald was out of control and was simply at the end of his rope for many reasons, one of which included that he thought he was going back to the DOC. And in fourth rule, that testimony will not allow it.
Mr. McMahon.
Judge, we objected to that testimony because on a couple of reasons. The proposed testimony of Mr. Bennett was neither admissible under Lynch nor is he qualified to give opinions about Laquan's mental state on or near October 20th, 2014. The other reason we objected, Judge, is because of this alleged or supposed investigation of a relative of Laquan McDonald. It had absolutely nothing to do. There's no causal connection between that investigation, if there was an investigation, or what the focus of that investigation might have been. There's no connection between any investigation and Laquan McDonald's activities on October 20th or the days leading up to October 20th. So we objected to that, relevance of that testimony as well, and you sustain that objection.
All right, and my findings were the investigation that was presented or offered in the offer of proof was an investigation of the uncle, whether he was a fit adult to be the foster parent or be the guardian for Laquan McDonald, and whether the premises that he was living at the time were proper for a minor. That has nothing to do with this case. So that's the reason why I did not allow that. Plus, we don't know the qualifications of this person from the Department of Family and Children Services as far as education, therapeutic training in those areas. We had another motion.
Yes, we had a witness from TASC. Mr. Salas, we reported that he would testify to the positive urine drops of Laquan McDonald from
and they were positive
on the marijuana and cocaine. same was for PC India. Two separate drops from at juvenile court. At least one of the incidents was testified to by our bunch of witnesses, I believe, and the court ruled that his testimony would not be allowed.
That's correct, Judge. We objected that the supposed test results, there was no proper foundation to Sales, not a qualified witness that can lay that foundation against Sales to change custody. But beyond that, what we argued is that test results or allegations of generalized drug abuse are not admissible under Lynch for the cases that we decided. For the one instance where there was crossover, well, that results are hearsay under Melendez versus Diaz versus Massachusetts, which is the United States Supreme Court decision. It says lab results are essentially testimonial in nature, and certified lab result is not admissible without proper chain of custody and foundation.
And then, excuse me for interrupting. In the Massachusetts case, what the Massachusetts prosecutor was doing was getting a certified certificate by a forensic chemist stating that the substance that they had examined in the chain of custody was a controlled substance. And my understanding also is the United States Supreme Court said this is hearsay and cannot be admitted into evidence.
That's correct. So we objected based on the nature of the evidence would be hearsay and that Mr. Salas cannot lay a proper foundation to admit
just one final point.
Sure, go ahead.
One part I left out was that we had a signed affidavit from Mr. Salas that clearly shows that the lab results are a business record kept in the normal course of business. So it is our position that that those results should absolutely come in based upon the fact that it is a business record. It's probably admissible.
Massachusetts seems to be the focus of our attention today. There's a great case from Massachusetts which said that hearsay is not allowed to ride in on the throne of a business record. So it still would be hearsay. Mr. Salas is not qualified as a forensic chemist, so anything he'd be testifying to would be something that someone told him or something that he read. So those are the reasons why he would not be able to testify. But your motion for those records were in opposition to the motion of cautious subpoena and express the documents. You were successful in that. But, all right, so that's everything. All right?
Yes, yes.
So just on that point, does that mean that you can enter the lab results as an exhibit?
How are you going to get them in? Don't be listening to him.
Okay.
All right, good.
Just checking.
All right, thank you. No, that's good. That's good. Thank you. Will you bring our witness to keep off?
All rise for the jury.
All right, well, this was a bench conversation between the judge and the two attorneys. Gail Pazitsky, a prosecuting attorney, who is our guest this morning.
Defense attorney.
Sorry, you're not a prosecutor, you're a defense attorney. What is it that goes through the judge's mind in dealing with what witnesses, what evidence can be introduced? What does he want?
Well, he looks at the law. I mean, that's why the judge is there. The judge is the referee of the law. Whether evidence comes in, whether evidence does not come in, can a witness testify, can a witness not testify? He has to weigh the legal arguments. He doesn't weigh the evidence itself. That's the job for the jury. He weighs the legal arguments between the defense and the prosecution. So, for example, what we saw here, one of the arguments was a video or a couple of videos or recordings that were given to the prosecution late. This case has been going on for a while. They had plenty of time to give it to the prosecution. Is it fair at this hour to play the tapes and give it to the prosecution last minute? Judges has they have great discretion whether or not to allow something like that. It's not error if the judge denies it because it came in late. The judges usually give you time before trial, and they tell you, okay, all the evidence have to be in by a certain time. You have to give the opposition certain evidence. So now, let's say something was discovered a few minutes, or not a few minutes, but just prior, the day before.
All right. The judge has spoken briefly to the jury. The jury is now back in the courtroom. The first witness has just been called. Let's now resume with our CLTV continuing coverage of the murder trial of police officer Jason Van Dyke.
Have a seat, ma'am. The seat's adjustable. The microphone's live, so pull your chair up to the microphone, speak into the microphone, and everybody will be able to hear your testimony. We greatly appreciate it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, ma'am. How are you?
I'm fine.
Thank you for coming in. You're here pursuant to subpoena, is that correct?
Yes.
And would you please introduce yourself and spell your first and last name, please?
Yvette Patterson, Y-V-E-T-T-E, Patterson, P-A-T-T-E-R-S-O-N.
Okay. And Ms. Patterson, I want to direct your attention to October 20th, 2014, at approximately 2 o'clock in the morning. Did you have an occasion to contact the Chicago Police Department via 911 that day?
Yes, I did.
And can you tell, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, why it is that you contacted 911?
Because I was coming home from a party, and I seen a young man sitting on the stairs. When I pulled into my bag, my lights automatically popped on. So I seen him sitting. He walked over. You know, he jumped up because I believe he seen the light, so he jumped up. And he walked. He didn't come close to the car, but he walked over, and he was like, "Can I see your car?" And I'm like, "What do you want with my car?" And he was like, "I just want to use it. I'm going to bring it right back." So me and him just laughing and talking. We talk. So I'm like, "No, you can't use my car." I said, "I don't even let my son drive my car." So, "No, you can't use the car." So he said, "Okay." And he started laughing. You know, we just sit there talking. I asked him, "Who are you?" And he was like, "I live upstairs." And I said, "No, you don't. I never seen you before." And he said, "Yes, I do." So I end up calling the police. I called the police for the simple fact because I wanted to go in the house.
Okay. You wanted to go inside your house.
Right.
And this individual said he lived above?
The next building over from me.
Okay.
That's where he said he lived.
And you didn't believe that to be truthful?
No, I didn't. Okay. Because I'd never seen him. I know his kinfolks, but, you know, I'd never seen his face.
Okay. And you said you wanted to get into the house. Were you fearful to go into the house with this individual there?
I wasn't fear at all. I wasn't fear. It was just the fact that, you know, I wanted to go in and I wanted to be sure that I was going to be okay getting out my car and going into the house. He didn't fear me because of the conversation we had. He seemed like, you know, he was a nice young guy or whatever.
Okay.
But, you know, still, I wanted to be protected to go in my house.
Okay, and that's why you called 911.
Exactly.
Do you remember this individual saying anything else to you other than what you've just testified to?
No, he didn't say anything else to me until he was with the police.
Okay. I'm going to direct your attention to on February 25th, 2015.
Mm-hmm.
You spoke to the FBI, is that correct?
Correct.
And on that date and time, they asked you about what this individual said to you, correct?
Correct.
And you told the FBI that the person said, "Who the F, F-U-C-K, do you know that lives here?"
That's how, exactly. That's how he addressed me.
Okay. And that was part of the reason why you called 911 as well?
Well, I called 911. Like I say, I called 911 because I wanted to go in my household safe. So okay. That's why I called 911. I never seen a young man before. No one ever is in the back of my house when I come in. I have came in 3-4 o'clock in the morning. No one is never out there. So I see someone out there that, yes, I'm going to call 911 because I want to get out of my car safe and I want to walk into my household safe.
Okay. And that's why you called the police, to be protected. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. And if I can show what I've marked as Defense Exhibit 17, I've showed to the state. May I approach the witness?
Sure.
Ma'am, I'll represent that this is it's called an event query from the Chicago Police Department. Mm-hmm. My question is, you don't have to read out the number if you don't want, but I'm pointing here to a phone number that indicates that is the number that called 911 to report that incident. My question is, do you recognize that phone number?
That's my phone number.
Okay. Is this still your phone number today?
Yes.
Okay. And the address on here, and again, you don't have to give the address out.
All right, listen, just so it's clear, the phone number nor the address will be published. Move on. Go ahead. But you can verify the numbers on it.
Do you still live at the address in which
yes.
the address of occurrence is indicated there?
Yes.
Okay. And that's the west side of Chicago, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And in the remarks comment for the event query, and tell me if this is what you remember telling the 911 caller.
Objection, Judge. This is hearsay. Some document.
It's a foundation. All right.
Do you remember telling the 911 dispatcher that you were parking your car behind a building and a male black with dreads with a black hoodie walked up to your car and asked you who she was looking for? The individual is now standing on Campbell by the school, and that you were afraid to get out of your car and go into the building. Does that sound like what you
yes.
told? Okay. And did you later find out who that individual was that you called 911 to report?
Yes. When I woke up, I seen the news, and I seen his picture on the news.
Okay. And who was that person?
Laquan.
Okay. Laquan McDonald?
Yes.
Okay. I have nothing further. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Cross-examination today.
Ma'am. You knew Laquan's relatives who lived near you, is that correct?
Yes.
And did they live in the next building?
Yes, they did.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Anything else?
No.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You too.
Can I have the attorneys over here for scheduling, please?
Another there are innumerable conferences with the judge, but he said this is about scheduling. I'm assuming that's talking about how many witnesses he had to be called today, and so he can get his calendar in order for how this trial is going to end.
All right, he's thinking about lunch.
Okay, how prosaic. But yeah, he wants to plan in deference to the jury. He's always being mindful that this is a. They all honor the fact that the jury is committing this amount of time to a very difficult, high-profile case, and he wants to be sure that they're taken care of.
Well, they've been there since 9 o'clock this morning, and they just heard their first witness today.
So this witness, the woman who encountered him, it was at 2 to 3 in the morning, I think, in the back of her home, and she didn't say she was terrorized by the experience, but felt that it was odd, and she didn't feel comfortable walking into her home. Again, the attempt by the jury, or the defense to present McDonald as a threatening individual.
Right, so it's very clear that this witness did not want to be called as a witness for the defense.
She used to be subpoenaed. Let's, Gail, let's break again. They just called their second witness of the morning. Let's go back to the courtroom.
Doctor, have a seat, please.
Thank you.
The chair is adjustable, the microphone's live, so if you could pull your chair up to the microphone a little bit more, please. There you go. All right. And speak into the microphone. Everybody will be able to hear your testimony, and it would be greatly appreciated. So thank you. Proceed, Ms. Wynn.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning.
Could you
please introduce yourself to the jury?
Good morning. I'm James Thomas O'Don.
Doctor, what is your occupation?
I'm a pharmacologist, pharmacist, and nutritionist.
Okay. What is a pharmacologist?
A pharmacologist is a scientist or a clinician who is involved in the discovery, development, analysis, testing, or evaluation of the effects of drugs on humans and animals.
And it involves pharmacology.
Pharmacology, or pharmacology from the Greek meaning drug, study of drugs.
And what is clinical pharmacology?
Well, clinical pharmacology is the last part. Most of the early part is in a laboratory, in test tubes or tissue cultures or in animals. Clinical pharmacology, anything where you use the word clinical, it means a human being. That's where we take the drug and test them in humans to see if they do what is shown in animals. And then post-market, post-approval, a clinical pharmacologist consults with physicians on selection and evaluation of the effects of drugs in patients.
Okay. Do you own your own business?
I do.
What is the name of that business?
My business name is Pharma Consultant Incorporated.
And what kind of service does your company provide?
For all intents and purposes, it's any services that I offer professionally. For instance, when I'm paid for my work at Rush, they pay my company. When I consult in litigation, civil lawsuit or criminal matter involving drugs, my company is paid. When I get paid royalties for my books, it's paid to my company. So I do litigation consulting, academic teaching, government consulting, editing and publishing and public speaking. And from time to time, for many years, I worked in pharmacies as a pharmacist. Just haven't done that in the last 8 years.
Okay, so you mentioned you also teach at Rush.
I'm on faculty at Rush. I'm an associate professor. I've been on faculty since 1979. I have teaching duties now, and I also have service responsibilities where I work on one of the research committees, and I'm also involved in the admissions committee for the medical college.
So what do you teach at Rush?
Most of my teaching is pharmacology, how drugs work, how drugs are tested, how drugs are evaluated. I teach international drug regulations. I teach ethics and health research. And I used to teach toxicology principles.
Okay. Can you give the jury a brief description of your education?
Yes, I have 3 college degrees, a bachelor's, a master's, and a doctorate. A bachelor's in pharmacy from the University of Illinois, a master's degree in nutrition from Rush University, and a doctor of pharmacy from the University of Michigan.
And what do you have to do to become a pharmacologist?
There are a couple different paths. What I did is I became a pharmacist first, and I took an additional degree in pharmacy, the doctor of pharmacy, and I did an additional year of training and a residency, and then had employed as a pharmacist first at County Hospital and then at Presbyterian St. Luke's, now Rush, and I was involved in clinical monitoring of drug therapy in patients. I was involved in teaching a few different universities. I started publishing, became more and more involved in actual drug evaluation. I applied for the membership in the College of American College of Clinical Pharmacology was accepted. I also applied to take a certification examination with the American Board of Clinical Pharmacology, which required extensive documentation of background research, scholarly activities, publications, and recommendations. And fortunately, when I took the examination, I passed the examination, which was in about 26 years ago. So now, aside from my, that's a fellow status in the American College of Clinical Pharmacology, diplomat of the American Board of Clinical Pharmacology. My academic rank is associate professor of pharmacology, and for several years, as a result of those, that credential, that background, I was also served as a course director for medical pharmacology. Others go and take degrees in pharmacology and then do research. I had a little bit different pattern. Pharmacology is a little bit different from most, from many medical disciplines in that it draws from a broad, wide arena of different training and experience bases. But the common theme is how do drugs work, how are they used, how do they cause harm, how can we avoid harm?
Thank you. So when you say American Board of Pharmacology, that does that mean you're board certified?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And you're licensed in Illinois?
I'm a licensed pharmacist in Illinois, yes.
Okay. And how do you become a licensed pharmacist?
50 years ago, you had to go to college and spend 5 years studying chemistry and pharmacology and pharmacognosy and other biological studies, spend 2,000 hours in vacation time working as an apprentice pharmacist, then take a board examination, which I did, and I was licensed in August of 1969.
Okay. And have you previously been on staff or affiliated with any academic or medical organizations that you did not mention already? I know you said Cook County Hospital, but any others?
I've been on faculty at the University of Illinois College of Pharmacy in two different periods, one in the 70s and one in the from 2007 to 2014. Faculty of the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Rockford, from 2000 to 2014. Faculty of the Northern Illinois University for 2 years in the 1980s when I taught pharmacology in their nutrition program. And I also was on faculty at Purdue University as a what's called a preceptor, where they sent graduate students to learn how to be hospital pharmacists. This is when I was at Cook County Hospital, now known as Stroger.
Okay. Can you tell the jury the difference between pharmacology and pharmacy?
Well, pharmacy includes the study of pharmacology, but also has additional training and responsibilities for taking a chemical that's proven to be a drug, proven to have drug actions, and actually making a medicine. So like taking a powder and putting it in cough syrup and having some other things so it tastes okay and it's stable and it's and then packaging it, labeling it, and then advising the patient how to use it safely. You get your prescriptions filled. That's a pharmacist. A pharmacologist, as I described, is usually not a pharmacist, but is usually involved in the research part of developing drugs. And a clinical pharmacologist is usually on the side of selecting and evaluating the effects of drugs.
Okay. Doctor, is toxicology part of pharmacology?
Yes, for human drugs, the study of pharmacology includes the unwanted or untoward or adverse or side effects of the drugs. Pharmacology, the study of drugs, how do drugs work. Most toxic effects are what we call extensions of the desired effect of the drug. It's usually a result of too much of the drug. And any drug indeed can be toxic if enough of it is taken. And so anybody that studies or anybody that teaches pharmacology has to learn about the adverse effects for a number of reasons. Number one, you want to try to avoid them. Number two, if you're a treater and you have a patient come in, you're not sure why they're sick. The first thing you have to do is, if they're taking it, are they taking any drugs? If you know what they're taking and you confirm it, try to rule out the drug effect versus some other cause for their illness.
So that would mean that you teach toxicology as well?
I've taught toxicology principles, and a large part of my consulting practice is evaluation of toxicology reports and testifying and writing reports on the toxicology of drugs involved in cases.
I know you mentioned books that you've authored before. How many books have you authored, and have you authored any research or publications in pharmacology?
I have 6 books that I'm an editor or co-editor of. 5 of them very heavily address adverse effects of drugs and drug development. One is a book that exclusively addresses the scientific methodologies used for development of drugs. Other publications in pharmacology, I have more than 300 publications in pharmacology, and among those, several dozen book chapters, again, most of them addressing the toxic effects of drugs.
And does the study of pharmacology involve PCP?
Yes.
Have you testified or consulted as an expert in the field of pharmacology and toxicity?
Yes, I am.
And how many times have you consulted?
Testified pharmacology and drug toxicity in court more than 400 times.
400?
More than 400.
How many times have you consulted?
More than 3,000 in 40 years.
Are these criminal cases, civil cases?
Most of them are civil cases. I would estimate 85 to 90% civil cases. The remaining criminal cases, a lot of the criminal cases include alcohol, but some include other drugs where, for instance, someone might be sleep driving from their Ambien and arrested for DUI, or cocaine found in their body, or marijuana, either use of it or testing positive for it. And I have consulted on some cases involving PCP. I testified in at least one trial in PCP. There may be a second one.
And in the criminal, well, in all the cases that you mentioned, actually, in the criminal, did you testify for the state or the defense?
In criminal cases, I have testified for the state or prosecutors. I have testified for the defense. Clearly, it's been more for the defense. In fact, the majority for the defense.
Okay. And were you paid by the defense in this case?
I have been paid. Yes.
How much?
I've been paid $10,000 to date. There will be additional billing for my time for preparation for trial and being here today.
Judge, at this time I tender Dr. O'Donnell as an expert in the field of pharmacology and toxicity.
No objection, Your Honor. I find that Dr. James O'Donnell is an expert in the field of pharmacology and toxicity.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Proceed, please.
Thank you. you. You were asked by our team to prepare a report opining on PCP and its effects on Laquan McDonald in this case, correct?
Yes.
Did you prepare a report?
I did.
Okay. Would it assist you today to view your report as you testify?
It would help me if I have it available, if I need it, yes.
Okay, Judge, I ask permission for the doctor to...
Did you consult with
I did.
The state?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Is that right, state?
Yes,
all right,
sir.
Thank you. Sir, the doctor can use the report as necessary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you prepare a PowerPoint presentation to assist the jury in learning about PCP and its effects?
I did.
Okay. What documents did you review in this case in preparing that PowerPoint and report?
I reviewed several different types of documents, the autopsy and toxicology report for Laquan McDonald, the police reports, some follow-up detective reports, the original video that everybody's seen. I reviewed the ambulance report, EMS report, the Mount Sinai hospital records. I reviewed reports of Dr. Keyes, reports of Dr. Miller. I've become aware of or read reports of some of the witnesses who testified in the trial so far. And I also reviewed, for purposes of providing references and authorities, several sources of PCP and what PCP is and what PCP does and how PCP does what it does. I think that's...
Did you also review the FBI summary?
The FBI summary, yes, thank you. And I also reviewed some medical history of Laquan McDonald, indicating prescription drugs that he had prescribed for him and what he would have been treated for.
Exit out, right? Thank you. What does your PowerPoint consist of?
Well, PowerPoint consists of what I would describe as fact-rich technical information, and listing what I reviewed, what information I considered in terms of how people at the scene described Laquan McDonald. It also described what PCP or phencyclidine is and what it does, particularly the toxicity. It includes some definitions. It also lays out short descriptions of the opinions that I'm prepared to offer regarding PCP and its effects on Laquan McDonald.
Okay. Judge, I'd ask to admit Defense 18 into evidence and publish to the jury.
I'm sorry, didn't hear it. Speak up, please.
I'm sorry. I'd ask to admit Defense number 18 into evidence as the PowerPoint of Dr. O'Donnell to assist the jury in understanding his testimony and publish to the jury.
So you want, are you saying you want to use that as demonstrative evidence?
Yes.
Any objections,
sir? Yes, Your Honor, I do object. This is information that does not need to be presented to the jury in the form of a document. The witness has just testified as to the material that he has reviewed in order to make a decision. So this will be essentially asked and answered. We're going to repeat it now with a slideshow. We don't have a problem with him describing his conclusions, but there is no reason to have those presented in writing to the jury. And Your Honor, description of what other officers did would be hearsay, would not be admissible at all, and certainly would not be appropriate to be visually displayed by this witness.
Defense, are there any quotes by officers in your power play?
We have a sidebar, please. Thank you.
We need you again. Thanks.
All right, again, and want one in the innumerable sidebars where the judge wants to talk to the attorneys. Let me introduce our new analyst for the moment. This is Michael Oppenheimer with Erickson and Oppenheimer, a criminal defense lawyer. You've done civil rights law.
Correct.
And you've been in this before that very judge, Judge Gahan.
I have.
And you tell him he's kind of, he is as he sounds, as he comes across, really a stickler for detail, keeps you on your toes, and he'll tell you when you're wrong, and even if it makes you look bad.
He absolutely does that, and you have to take it and be confident and then move on. He's a great guy, great judge, and he moves his courtroom.
Yeah. So the two witnesses we've had today, one was a woman who had encountered Laquan McDonald in the morning of the shooting, very early in the morning, felt uncomfortable, didn't feel directly threatened, but enough discomfort that she called the 911 number to have police just get her into her own home. He was not of the neighborhood that we claimed to be. He wanted to borrow her car. She didn't understand why he would do that. But anyway, another, I guess, in the string of witnesses that the defense is trying to show that this was a guy who was certainly at least acting oddly, if not threateningly, in the days and certainly hours before the shooting.
Correct. I mean, this is the week that they get to put Laquan McDonald on trial, and they are doing their best to do that, although sometimes it's not so effective. But yes, they're trying to put Laquan McDonald on trial, and they get to do that.
And this attorney is, they spent 20-plus minutes validating his expertise in pharmacology, the study of drugs and the effect on living organisms, in this case a human being, and we presume this is all going to be over the PCP, the illegal illicit drug that Laquan McDonald was found to have had in his body at the autopsy.
I think so. And although Van Dyke couldn't have known that he was on PCP at the time, he is allowed to bring that in because it goes under People versus Lynch. You're allowed to bring stuff in to show that he was more dangerous to let the jury help make that decision. And that's what they're going to do. It's a dangerous drug.
And we've seen testimony for the defense where yesterday a police officer said, well, you see that dash cam video, but that was not our perspective. Our perspective, we saw his face and it was deranged. Trying to make the case that maybe his movements weren't overtly threatening, but they were drawing a lot of information when they looked into his face and saw this sort of vacant, menacing stare.
Absolutely. It's all about what Van Dyke reasonably believed from where he was, and that's what Officer Wallace testified to when the prosecution put him on. Nobody knows why they did that, but they did, and it helps go to show what Van Dyke recently believed from his vantage point.
Walsh, who came for the prosecution, used to say he was his partner felt that there was a different perspective that was not necessarily seen from the only perspective we have had, which is the dash cam video. And then a couple of days ago, they introduced that animation, that animated version of a video sequence, trying to create what the perspective was for McDonald. It didn't look really all that different from what I would have guessed would have been their perspective by just looking at the dash cam video.
Correct. They probably spent a lot of money on it. It was made in California. They brought the guy in from California. It did show, from what I saw, Laquan McDonald getting a little closer, but it didn't show him acting menacingly. I don't think it helped him that much. And if I'm the prosecution, I portrayed as a paid cartoon, paid for by the defense, yeah, to try and change the jury's mind from the real thing, which is the video.
We've just been told that they are on a recess now. This could go on for a few more minutes, but let's keep our conversation going.
Sure.
We might just take a quick break in just a second. Why don't we do that now? Let's take a commercial break. We'll be back in a moment. Michael Oppenheimer, an expert on criminal defense, is our guest. He'll be helping us understand the nuances of the trial. But for now, let's take a break. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Bill Mahler with our continuing coverage here on CLTV of the murder trial of Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. Welcome back to the WGN and CLTV newsroom. I am Bill Mahler. This is part of CLTV's continuing coverage of the entire courtroom drama of the People versus Van Dyke, the murder trial of police officer Jason Van Dyke. This is certainly a case that is getting national attention. Driving in today for the hour and nearly 50 minutes it took me to get here, I heard several times on national news this trial being mentioned. So it has a lot of people watching, and in fact it is the first time that a police officer has been charged with murder in nearly 40 years here in Chicago. Michael Oppenheimer is an attorney. He has a lot of experience, not just in the courtroom, but before this very judge, Vincent Gahan, and he works for Erickson and Oppenheimer in the city of Chicago. And how would you characterize the professionalism of the two sides here, the prosecution and the defense?
Speaking frankly, it is my understanding that Dan Herbert has never tried a murder case before. He has brought in other attorneys. Randy Rueckert has tried cases in the past. Just an experienced criminal defense attorney. So it's interesting that one of the biggest cases in this city's history, that the lead attorney has never tried a murder case before. He does a lot of work for the FOP and the police unions. The prosecution side has been brought in from another county due to conflicts of interest. So I don't know how experienced they are in these kind of cases, especially in Cook County. So it's very interesting. I think both sides have made pluses and both sides have made mistakes, which is going to happen all the time. I haven't been that impressed so far, but we'll have to see.
So you're talking about in terms of points that they should have been pressing and extraneous witness testimony that has been introduced that has nothing really to do to support their side?
Sure. That happens sometimes where you think a witness is important and they turn out not to be important. Sometimes, no matter how many trials...
How can you not know, though, if you're calling a witness, what they are going to say? Is it because they changed their story?
I wondered that with Officer Walsh. Officer Walsh had been given what's called use immunity for
testimony. Again, for those who don't know, this is the partner of Jason Van Dyke, and it was the prosecution last week who called him.
Correct. He's been indicted for conspiracy, I believe, and falsifying police reports.
One of three officers who have changed their story. When their first report was made immediately afterwards, they were saying that this guy was coming at him with a raised knife, threatening them directly. There was no other option. It was self-defense, clearly. But the dash cam video came out about a year later and showed that it wasn't the case.
Correct. So you know he's going to be biased towards his partner. You know he's going to want to protect his partner. So you should have prepared him a dozen times to know what he's going to say and then be prepared if he flips on you. Flipping mean say something else, which is what he did. And if he flips on you, you have to attack him like any other witness and say, you told us when we met last time this, this, and this, and now you're a liar, and now you're changing your story, and then align him more with Van Dyke, and then you get a chance under cross-examination to portray both of them as in this together. And you do what we call dirtying up Van Dyke through Officer Walsh. The prosecution did not do that. They let it slide, and it hurt them. It hurt them a lot, and it was in the beginning of their case, and we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, I remember him saying in testimony under oath that the perspective that we have was very different from the perspective that they had when they got to the car. This guy was menacing. He had a terrorized look on his face. He was. We felt he was very threatening. He did say, though, that he was surprised when gunfire broke out on the part of his partner.
He did, because he hadn't fired, and that is helpful to the prosecution, but I think that is outweighed by him giving essentially Van Dyke a self-defense case, saying, I was right there, I knew it from his perspective, he protected us, which is the essence of the self-defense claim, and that hurt the prosecution a lot.
And in fact, they were talking about how it's part of their training in the way that they responded, that this wasn't a willful intent or right racially biased response, but part of how he had to very quickly size up the situation. There was a Burger King and a Dunkin' Donuts. I have to keep remembering to call it now Dunkin'. A half a block or so away. They wanted to corral him and keep him from going in that direction, but he was walking very directly, purposefully forward in that direction, and that was playing into their thoughts as well. So they're trying to chip away at this whole idea that it was not willful murder, but in fact an act of self-defense.
That's exactly where they're going with it. And the prosecution has not asked for any other charges, as far as I know, besides the aggravated battery. So we'll see if they ask for a self-defense instruction or if the defense does, because that gives the jury another option.
Okay, Michael Oppenheimer, court has again resumed. Let's go back to criminal courts building downtown for the continuing testimony.
Doctor, you're still under oath. All right, proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge, at this time I ask to admit defense number 18 into evidence and publish to the jury.
All right, is it demonstrative evidence or what?
Yes.
No, yeah. It's your motion, your exhibit. What is it?
Well, it's Yes, it's demonstrative for identification purposes, Judge.
All right, thank you. All right, it will be admitted in as demonstrative evidence, and the identification marks will be stricken, and you will be allowed to publish. Proceed.
Thank you. To play the PowerPoint and ask that you explain each slide as we move through it. Right now, slide number one. Could you please explain this slide?
Well, this was the background as to materials reviewed by myself, a pharmacologist. These are the types of materials that one would have to review.
Dr. Oney testified to the things that you reviewed for this case.
These are the materials I reviewed for this case in order to develop the opinions I'm prepared to give in this case, and we've already talked about them.
Okay. Thank you. I'm now going to skip to the next slide. Could you please explain this slide?
Yes, we talked about toxicity and toxicology, and this slide presents the significant toxicology findings for testing of Laquan McDonald's blood that was sampled at autopsy.
Okay.
Shall I proceed?
Please.
It lists PCP, which is an inconvenient shorthand for phencyclidine, at a level of 56 nanograms per milliliter. It also identifies that two other drugs were tested and shown not to be present. And those drugs are valproic acid and risperdal. So this means, just put it a different way, the toxicology lab was asked to run tests for these because there was some history of them being prescribed to Mr. McDonald, but the toxicology lab did not find any documented presence of them in his blood.
So you're talking about the toxicology testing that was done along with the autopsy, correct?
Yes.
What is the significance of 56 nanograms?
Well, it's a number that represents a moderate to low level of PCP for severe toxic effects where the patient's life is at risk, but it's a level that has been reported and associated with psychiatric toxicities. And having said that, and reminding you of what I said earlier, is that toxicity is usually an extension of or seen at higher doses. PCP is somewhat unique in that people could be very toxic to the effects of PCP and not have taken a high dose. The amount that they swallow or smoke or inject, or have a high blood level like this level here. So this tells me as a pharmacologist that PCP was used within a relatively recent period, for certain the day of the shooting, and that he had the potential for having toxic effects of PCP presence based on the finding of this drug in his blood.
Did you say as recent as that day?
Yes. Because of the length of time it takes for the drug to be eliminated, given that PCP has a very long half-life, contrast to something like heroin or cocaine, which is much shorter than we're always talking about hours. PCP has a half-life that's at a minimum 12 to 14 hours, and that means someone can have therapeutic or toxic effects of PCP for days instead of hours like the other drugs I mentioned.
And what are one's reactions to PCP at 56 nanograms.
Well, the particular effects are can be, the drug is used for euphoria, for the high. The drug could cause hallucinations, delusions, behavioral changes, aggression, violence. PCP itself is described as a dissociative anesthetic. Anesthetic means to anesthetize, to inhibit the nerve's ability to detect and transmit pain impulses. Dissociative anesthetic means that the patient is anesthetized and can be awake and alert, and they're described as having wide open eyes and a blank facies, a flat affect facies. And, so those are the effects that can occur at this level as opposed to a higher level where you can get into severe cardiac toxicity or respiratory toxicity and even coma. But these are the levels that are present when someone's awake and walking. May not be able to talk, but they may also be talking.
Not being able to talk is an effect of PCP?
PCP intoxication, they're subjects or patients described to be mute. They're unable to talk or unable to form words, frequently described as making noises.
And you said that it acts as a anesthetic.
Is it anesthetic?
Does that mean they can't feel?
It means they can't. They're unable to feel pain.
Okay.
They have adequate levels of the drug present. That's what anesthetics are used for. It's like if you need to have surgery on your arm, the arm is anesthetized so that when the surgeon uses a scalpel to open the skin, you don't feel it. That's what the drug is used for. So many patients, subjects, abusers of PCP may not be able to feel pain because of the drug. And also PCP at this level, which may explain some of the psychiatric toxicities, is it gives the user a almost superhuman strength, the feeling of omnipotence, the feeling of being able to do anything, and leads to significant bizarre behavior, frequently described as psychotic behavior.
Okay. You stated that the medical examiner's office tested for risperidol and valproic acid. Okay. What are those two drugs?
Well, valproic acid is a drug that's used to stabilize moods. It also has other uses. In terms of mood stabilization, it's frequently used in bipolar disease. And that is what my understanding is. That's the most frequent use of valproic acid.
And what is risperidol?
Risperidol is classified as an atypical antipsychotic. It's used to treat mental illness. It can be used for severe mood disorder as a mood stabilizer. It also can be used to treat psychosis, schizophrenia.
And so those are psychotropic drugs.
These are psychotropic drugs. All the drugs here on this slide here, the PCP, the risperidol, the valproic acid, are psychotropic drugs. Psychotropic, it means controlling the mind. They have an effect on the mind, psycho-mind-trope control.
And why was Laquan McDonald tested for those in the autopsy?
Because because he had a history of having been prescribed them recently. And the medical examiner was requested to test for the presence of these drugs.
And you noted that these drugs were, they weren't, neither of them were detected in the lab.
Answer, sustained.
Okay. Well, what is the significance of these two drugs not being present in Laquan McDonald's body?
Well, if he's not getting the drug, he's not getting the benefit of taking the drugs. The drugs were prescribed for a psychiatric condition, and PCP, even in a patient without any psychiatric illness or any mental illness, can cause severe psychiatric toxicity in a person who has any psychiatric history. It can exacerbate or worsen any underlying mental illness. So the significance here is that these were prescribed for him. He wasn't taking them. He took the psychotropic drug PCP, phencyclidine, which can cause severe rage, aggression, violent behavior, drug-induced psychosis, and he's in a more vulnerable state for a more severe reaction to the PCP because he's not getting the protection of his prescribed drugs that his doctor was giving him.
Okay, I want to move to the next slide. Could you explain what this
I wanted to bring just together some facts because I know that there's been a lot of reference to PCP without, and I don't know how much discussion, and as a professor, this is how I teach doctors and pharmacists and nurses using this method. It helps remind me of what to say, but it also provides...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm objecting to the narrative answer to the question.
Judge, he's an expert.
That doesn't mean he could just
explain it.
Just start talking with no questions. All right, doctor, answer the questions.
Sure.
Sustain. Move on.
This is background information to the...
Doctor, wait for the question.
Okay. Explain what PCP is, please.
Well, PCP is phencyclidine. It is a chemical that was first synthesized, made in a laboratory approximately 100 years ago. It was introduced into use in medicine as an anesthetic in the late 1950s, perhaps 60 years ago. It was used as an anesthetic in preparing for patients for surgery for a short period of time, but quickly abandoned because of the severe psychiatric toxicity. People woke up and they were having severe hallucinations. They were borderline psychotic, they had delusions, and they just complained. So very quickly the drug was abandoned because of that. Unfortunately, PCP got into the drug culture and it was abused certainly very frequently in the 70s and 80s, pretty much abandoned from use in the 90s, but it keeps cropping back in because it is abused. It's a hallucinogen. It causes bizarre reactions. It causes delusions. And it has an effect on behavior, as I described earlier, to particularly in men, to be more aggressive, both physically, sexually, superhuman powers. And it is a drug that, because of the psychiatric toxicities, even at low doses, can put a patient into risk to themselves and also risk to people around them.
Thank you. I'm going to move to the next slide. Doctor, could you define psychosis?
Yes. Well, I brought this in because perhaps not everybody knows what that means, but it's really a distortion of reality, an out of touch with reality.
I don't object, Your Honor, to the witness testifying beyond the scope of your expertise.
when?
Judge, I'm going to tie this in his testimony. Wait a moment. Psychosis is...
Objection to the matter.
You just stated a conclusion. Here's the thing, is that the doctor has been qualified to testify as an expert in the area of pharmacology and toxicology. And he has expertise in the area of the effects of drugs on human beings. And so he's defining his terms. At this time, your objection will be overruled.
Thank you. Could you define psychosis, please?
Psychosis is a very severe psychiatric condition. Acute schizophrenia is an example, psychotic break. The point is what I have to talk about, we have to teach it when we teach pharmacology.
Okay.
Doctor, please, you know, define the term. Don't give us a clinical history about other mental illnesses that don't exist in this case.
Politician. Some drugs can cause psychotic reactions. They cause a departure from reality. They look just like a non-drug psychosis. And clinical pharmacologists sometimes consult and help doctors determine.
Doctor, focus. Define the term psychosis.
Thank you. I am.
Thank you. Can PCP cause psychosis?
Yes.
Thank you. Doctor, could you please state your opinion based on all that you've reviewed in this case that you've already named as to PCP intoxication in Laquan McDonald?
Yes. First, we know that he was using PCP. That's documented by the fact it's in his blood. In my opinion, based on all the evidence I reviewed, he was intoxicated and impaired by PCP at the time of his death. I explained earlier, in my opinion, he was not taking the valproic acid and the risperidone, and so therefore did not have the protection that those would have provided to him. And without that, his reaction to PCP is potentially much greater. So that covers this slide.
Sorry. Okay. Could you speak to Laquan McDonald's behavior? How this PCP intoxication affected his behavior?
It affected his behavior as demonstrated by aggression, failure to heed orders from the police, assault on the police vehicle, continuing aggressive movement toward Officer Van Dyke. His description is that he was deranged. He had was making noises. He looked unfazed. He looked like he was looking over us or through us. This is clinic. What I would describe as clinical evidence of a rage, aggressive, violent person. That is, in my opinion, caused by the PCP that he had used.
And are these opinions based on a reasonable degree of pharmacological certainty?
Yes, they are.
And what is the basis for your opinions?
Well, putting the two together, we have the the toxicology report on one hand, and I said earlier that it shows the potential for an effect, because you just can't take a number and say this is what it did. The description of what he was observed to be doing is evidence of bizarre, aggressive behavior. You put the two together, that to me says he was impaired, he was intoxicated, there's a slang term, he's whacked on this PCP at the time of his death.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Relax there, Mr. Colon. Let him. Mr. Cobb.
Thank you. Doctor, you would agree that the defendant, Jason Van Dyke's behavior could only be affected by what he knew about Laquan McDonald. Wouldn't you agree to that?
Objection.
Overruled. Yes.
And, of course, none of your reports indicated that the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, had any training or experience in toxicology or pharmacology. Is that correct?
I'll let this one, the doctor can answer this question and then move on from that area.
That's correct.
Now, you testified that PCP at the levels found in Laquan McDonald's body could cause rage or aggression. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, you also testified that it could cause psychosis or what you call erratic behavior. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
I want to talk about what objective manifestations of rage did Laquan McDonald demonstrate to the defendant, Jason Van Dyke?
Proceeding toward him with a knife in his hand and appearing to be looking through them or over them after he...
Okay, let me stop you there. So you testified that one of the objective manifestations was victim looking through Jason Van Dyke or looking over him. Is that correct?
Yes.
How do you know that he did that?
From Officer Walsh's testimony.
Well, how do you know that the defendant saw him looking through or over him?
I don't know.
So this would be an assumption on your part. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, what other manifestation? So your conclusion or your assumption is that looking through or over a person is a manifestation of rage, correct?
That in itself is not a manifestation of rage. Taken in the context of all the other activities that Officer Van Dyke was aware of, and then seeing this man approaching him with a knife, and is an aggressive and can be described as a part of aggression is rage.
Okay, I get it. So, looking over and through, that's one way of demonstrating rage. And then walking toward a person is another demonstration or manifestation of rage?
I think you're simplifying it too much, if I may. Those processes in and of themselves are not erratic behavior or manifestations of rage, but in the context of being chased after attacking a vehicle and having several police officers chasing them, he's still refusing to drop the knife and proceeding toward the officer.
All right, let me break that up then. Now, what evidence did Jason Van Dyke have that Laquan McConnell attacked a vehicle?
He knew that he had popped a tire by a police vehicle.
And that's all he knew, correct?
That's all he heard from the... Yes, that's all I'm saying he knew.
So he knew that a tire was popped, correct?
Yes.
And then several minutes later, he knew that the vehicle was still operating because he saw it, correct?
He saw it, yes. There were several police there, and he saw the vehicle following the one.
And he knew that both of the occupants of that vehicle were completely healthy, correct?
Well, I assume that he knew that he would know that for the one officer who was driving. I don't know that he knew that the partner in the car, Officer Velez, was completely healthy.
Well, actually, it wasn't Officer Velez who was in the car, but as you read from the reports, it was Gaffney driving in the car. As you know from the report, he saw, would have seen Gaffney drive through the Burger King parking lot, correct?
Okay, I was thinking of the wrong squad car, but yes.
Okay,
as far as I'm concerned, Officer Van Dyke did not think that Gaffney and his partner were injured.
Okay, so in what he knew about what you described as rage, he knew that there was a tire popped, correct?
Yes.
Objection.
Overruled. And he knew that a taser was called for, correct?
Correct.
Which would be a non-lethal use of force, correct?
The doctor's not qualified to use the force sustained.
Okay. So that's what he knew about the progression of what happened. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Now, he also knew that there was a man standing on the corner pointing in the direction that Laquan McDonald was running, correct?
Yes.
And that man was unharmed, correct?
Yes.
So he knew that Laquan McDonald had not demonstrated his rage by harming the man on the street, correct?
Correct.
And he knew that Laquan McDonald was running from the squad cars chasing him, correct?
Correct.
So he wasn't manifesting aggression toward the police. He was running from the police, correct?
Well, he was running toward Officer Van Dyke's vehicle.
Okay, but not immediately, was he? Officer Van Dyke would have seen Laquan McDonald open the knife, is that correct?
Yes.
And then he demonstrated his rage by stabbing the vehicle he was right next to when he opened the knife?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I may have misheard your last question. Officer, who observed him demonstrating his rage?
Well, did Van Dyke watch him demonstrating his his rage by flipping open the knife?
Related to popping the tire?
No, after Van Dyke saw him on Pulaski Road.
Okay, yes, Van Dyke saw that, and that's a sign of aggression and rage.
Okay. And then Laquan McDonald manifested his flight from the police by not stabbing that squad he was next to, but immediately walking, veering away from that squad and towards a fence, didn't he?
Yeah.
Overall, the doctor said he's in the video.
Didn't he?
Yes.
And then Laquan McDonald continued to walk away from police officers toward an empty fence, or a fence in front of an empty lot. Did he not?
He did.
And is that what you describe as rage?
Yes.
Okay. You would not describe that as avoidance of conflict. Is that correct?
Well, he had not avoided the conflict yet. He's still in a situation with a knife in his hand and ignoring and disobeying police orders to drop the knife and still showing aggressive behavior and actions, I would describe that as violent rage behavior.
Okay, so ignoring is violence. Is that the way you're describing it?
I don't think it's reasonable, if I may, to take a word out of a complex answer and ask them to just say that ignoring is violence. The constellation, the accumulation, all the actions of Mr. McDonald, to me, demonstrate an aggressive, psychotic behavior that was caused by his PCP.
But you described, was there anything else Laquan McDonald did to demonstrate that, what you call rage, to the defendant?
No.
Now, you talked about that PCP can cause superhuman strength, is that correct?
Yes.
Did Laquan McDonald demonstrate any superhuman strength on the night of August 20th, 2014?
Not to my knowledge.
And you talk about that in males it can cause sexual aggression, is that correct?
Yes.
Did he demonstrate any sexual aggression on that night?
No.
In fact, Rudy Borales' wife was outside of the car and he did not engage in any sexual aggression toward her, did he?
No, only knife aggression toward Mr. Borales.
And with his superhuman strength, did he overcome Mr. Borales' will and stab him?
No, he didn't.
So what was he demonstrating by that? The intent to attack or the intent to go away?
Well, he did attack. So he had an intent and he did do it. Mr. Borales, fortunately, was able to fend him off. I think he said he threw a cell phone at him.
He did, and a handful of pebbles as well, wasn't it?
Right. Remember, this man...
Thank you. I have no further questions, Doctor.
Ms. Wynn.
Nothing gets done after.
Thank you, Doctor. Can I have the attorneys over here quickly?
Michael Oppenheimer, our expert witness here for analysis on this trial. He ended on a very strong point. That was a nice, deft kind of theatrical turn where he said this kid was on in a rage and acting violently. He thwarted him with just a handful of gravel.
Absolutely. I like that. It was dramatic. It will stick in the jury's mind that here is a person who you're portraying as aggressive and dangerous, and he got him to go away with a handful of pebbles. And then they'll argue later, handful of pebbles versus 16 shots. So it was effective, and they ended on a good note.
Yeah. That point about the 16, though, is kind of interesting. The video that was a recreated animation for the defense stopped right when the image of Laquan McDonald hit the ground. It did not show the repeated bang, bang, bang that kept going. I have to believe that is a determinant in regard to first-degree murder. That is, that he wasn't just disabling the threat of the moment, that he had some motivation to keep firing. We don't know what that was. And would that fact, that it wasn't just two or three shots, but a full clip of 16, argue for a charge of first-degree murder?
Absolutely. It goes towards Van Dyke's intent. Police officers are trained to eliminate the threat. And their argument is that this is not eliminating the threat. This is essentially murder. It's essentially, why did you have to do that? I think the public kind of feels that way. The video is disturbing. And I think that's the biggest takeaway from the video, that he was not coming at Van Dyke, but the 16 shots, that he could have stopped. The initial demonstration early on last week about the time it took, 14 seconds versus, I think, 5 seconds to fire those shots, shows that he was slow and deliberate, and that goes towards intent.
To blunt the argument, they're presenting witness testimony and some evidence to show that this was a violent young man in a rage, high on PCP, though it wasn't an extreme amount in a level of toxicity in his system, but enough in his body, and it was not mitigated by the drugs that he was supposed to be taking for mental illness. So the argument, I guess, that they're trying to make is that this is a violent young man. You police have to deal with violent young men all the time, and in this case, this was a warranted use of force to disable that violence and the threat.
That is the defense argument. The prosecution's argument is that you don't need 16 shots to do it because he wasn't acting with the strength of 10 men. That PCP could cause that, but he wasn't doing it that night. He wasn't doing all those things that they want to make the big bad PCP does, and that therefore Van Dyke didn't know he was on PCP at the time, even though it's admissible at trial, and that he wasn't this violent, aggressive man, and that's the counter.
Did not only not know that fact, but did not know the history of this young man, the fact that he had been causing some measure of trouble in the 24 hours before the shooting. All he knew was what he saw when he got out of the car and took 2+ seconds to decide to pull the trigger.
Absolutely, and that's what really should come in here. It's what happened during that time, that Illinois Supreme Court case, People versus Lynch, lets that in. Other jurisdictions don't allow that. It seems unfair to a lot of people that all this stuff about Laquan McDonald, putting him on trial for stuff that Van Dyke has no clue about and wouldn't have known, shouldn't come in. And I kind of agree with that. But that's the law. It's allowed to come in, and hopefully...
So it's not just the judge's discretion. He's actually using that very case to have the latitude for the defense to bring some of this stuff in.
Correct. Yes.
So they're on a lunch break right now. We don't know what's going to happen afterwards, presumably more testimony. Let me ask you this question while we have you. The argument as to whether the defendant himself should stand trial. Obviously, we don't know, other than what we've heard in a Tribune interview and a WBEZ interview, what he sounds like, how he thinks, how effective he might be. But that has to play into it, is how strong can you stand up to what would probably be withering cross-examination?
I mean, this is the cross-examination that these people hopefully have been training for 2 years. It's every trial lawyer's dream to cross-examine is from the prosecution side, the defendant. If he takes the stand, they get a chance to do that. So his defense team better be able to know, and they would have practiced and practiced and practiced with other lawyers, that he can withstand this cross-examination. Otherwise, they're in trouble.
Yeah. Even as the jury achingly wants to hear him question about what was going through your mind. Why did you decide to keep pulling the trigger and emptying your clip? Those are the kinds of core key questions that every juror is going to be wrestling with if they don't hear that from him.
They absolutely want that. Every jury wants that, probably even more in this case through the nature of the case, but it is his constitutional right not to testify, and they will be instructed by the judge to disregard, not include the fact that he didn't testify in their deliberations.
So we've just had two witnesses in the defense trial today. This is the fourth day of defense testimony and entering of evidence. We don't know what's going to come up this afternoon. In your expert, and it all depends on how many more witnesses they want to call. If they don't call Van Dyke, if they do not call any other witnesses, could presumably we have closing arguments today?
I think that they will, it's a good question. I think there's enough time for that. If they don't call any other witnesses, they can rest. Many times the judge, in a case like this, the judge will take a break, have the jury come back early tomorrow morning, and closing arguments would start first thing tomorrow morning, give everybody a chance to prepare. In smaller, shorter cases, even in murder cases, you would go right into closing arguments once they rest. But I think in this case, he would give the jury time and the attorneys time to prepare.
Yeah, we don't know about tomorrow, too. He gave the jury Friday off last week, but if he feels they can finish it all, maybe he would want to be wanting to do that before the week's out.
I would agree. He would probably do that.
All right, that's Michael Oppenheimer with Erickson and Oppenheimer from downtown. Are you going to stick around, by the way, during the lunch break?
Sure.
I'll go buy you a hamburger or something and keep him here. I'm Bill Motto. This is part of our continuing coverage of the murder trial of he's still a police officer for Chicago Police Department, Jason Van Dyke. They are on lunch break. And we will resume our coverage once that is over, so stay tuned. We'll stay in the building, actually, and bring that to you once it happens. Thanks so much. This is...